You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. France in the New World, in New France. That's what we're going to be talking about. New France. What used to be called New France is in Canada, Eastern Canada, and a little bit was in the area of what is now the United States. It was all called New France until the British invaded, persistently invaded until they conquered the area. Now, when you compare the French colonization to the Spanish and British colonization, it was not as extensive. But theirs was very humane and tempered and done with great concern for the native people. They spread their influence through fur trading, converting and civilizing the Indians, and a gradual settlement and colonization. In the next Setting the Record Straight program to follow this one, I'm going to particularly concentrate on the area that used to be known as Arcadia in eastern Canada. The Arcadians had a flourishing colony for 150 years before the British drove them out. In a brutal migration, a trail of tears, on which 60% died on the way. The few survivors became the Cajuns in Louisiana. But back to the beginning of the story. Think of the place names in Canada and in the United States. Quebec, Montreal, Detroit, Chicago, the Mississippi Valley, New Orleans. These are areas where the French spread their influence. Now, Spain and Portugal had blazed the trail to the New World. They were the first. But France was not far behind. The country of France lay just across the Pyrenees Mountains from another Catholic nation, Spain. These nations were rivals. Yes, France was a Catholic nation under a Catholic king. Yet too often more concerned with advancing its own power than with advancing the faith. More than once in the 16th and 17th century, French kings and prime ministers had made alliances with the enemies of the Catholic Church in order to undercut the power of Spain and the Habsburg rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was still in existence at that time. This didn't mean that the majority of people of France were not loyal Catholics. They were loyal Catholics. And most of those who led France's ventures into the New World did so out of a sense of mission. The mission to spread the faith as well as discover new lands and open up commercial opportunities. In the 5th century, way back, King Clovis had been baptized in the area that is now France. He was the first barbarian chieftain to become a Catholic and to bring his tribe with him into the Catholic Church. Ever since, France has been a Catholic nation, sometimes called the eldest daughter of the Church. Now, the French would take this Catholicism with them into the New World, into New France. The first explorer who departed Europe for the New World in the name of France was actually from Genoa. He was Genovese. His name was Giovanni Verrazzano. You may know the Verrazzano Bridge, which crosses over into Manhattan, named after him. King Francis I commissioned Verrazzano to find a passage through the North American continent, a shortcut to China. This was the mythical Northwest Passage. Of course, it didn't exist, but they were looking for it. But Francis hoped that France would find it first, thereby reducing the power of Spain in the New World. Verrazzano left France in January of 1524. That's very early, isn't it? 1524. 49 days later, he landed near the present site of Wilmington, North Carolina. He then proceeded up the coast of Virginia and Maryland into the Bay of New York, exploring Staten Island. He sailed on up to Newfoundland. Nothing much came of his voyage, though, because Francis I was captured by the British Army. So despite these discoveries, there was no follow-up. 1532, Francis had been released. He was making a pilgrimage at the great Momanesque Monastery of Mont-Saint-Michel. I'm sure you've seen pictures of Mont-Saint-Michel, the medieval town on a high hill on a small circular island just offshore with a causeway leading to it. While he was there, a young man named Jacques Cartier knelt before him, asking for support for a voyage to the New World. The abbot of Mont Saint-Michel warmly recommended Cartier to the king, and Francis sponsored his voyage. Cartier made three voyages of discovery, sighting Labrador in May of 1534, exploring the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the St. Lawrence River. He came upon a rocky promontory.
It was rugged, bare rock, rising monumentally out of the riverbank.
This fair place would become the queen city of the New France, Quebec. Further up the St. Lawrence River, he found another well-situated Indian village of log houses. When he went ashore, the Indians were sure he was some kind of medicine man and begged him to cure the sick people. Somewhat bewildered, Cartier prayed for the sick that God would cure them, since he couldn't. The village he was in was known as Hochelaga to the Indians, but later on it would be called Montreal. Cartier and his men spent the winter of 36 in Quebec. They found the Canadian blizzards far different from the winters in France, and many of the men suffered from scurvy until an Indian recommended that they eat leaves of an evergreen tree. Cartier returned to France next July with many stories of the beauty of Canada and with Indian legends of great wealth somewhere to the east, as they said. 5 years later, Cartier made his third voyage. He'd asked the French officials to provide him with colonists, but they gave him convicts. The convicts had a choice of being hung or colonized in Canada.
After they experienced the Canadian winter, some of them probably wished they'd chosen to be hung.
Cartier took the survivors back to France in the spring. There were a few more attempted colonies, but none of them survived. The first lasting colony had to wait for Samuel Champlain.
Historians have awarded Champlain the title of the Father of New France.
About 30 years after Cartier's last voyage, he was born. He'd already made voyages to Mexico and Panama when he became interested in Canada.
His first voyage to New France occurred in 1603.
When he sailed up the St. Lawrence and took possession for France of an island which he named Île Saint-Jean. When the British came and took it over and drove the French out, they renamed it. It's now Prince Edward Island. He spent the winter, 1605, at Saint Croix.
It was so cold that the cider and the wine froze in the cask. It had to be served out in chunks.
Scurvy killed 35 out of the 79 men that were there. But Champlain came back 3 years later and built a colony on the site of Quebec, at the foot of the rocky promontory. 28 men spent the first winter there, braving the bitter cold and the lack of food. He set up a daily schedule to occupy them and got them to entertain each other to keep up their spirits. The men survived and even had some food to share with a group of starving Indians who had fought their way across the shifting ice.
As soon as the weather was warm enough, Champlain was exploring again. He reached the border of Canada.
He got down to the border of Canada and Vermont and discovered the lake which now bears his name, Lake Champlain. In 1615, he brought over the first missionaries, a bunch of Franciscans called the Recollect Fathers. Accompanied by two of them, he plunged deep into the territory of the Huron Indians, reaching Lake Ontario and Lake Huron. The French were tremendously impressed with the deep woods, the meadows, pine thickets, and the abundant game. One of the Franciscans remained with the Indians to preach the gospel, while Champlain and his men continued exploring and organizing fur trading with Huron.
And also with the Indians called Mactanus, with whom he was on excellent terms. The French consistently had warm relationships with the native Indian tribes.
About 10 years later, the first three Jesuit missionaries arrived
and began their great work of evangelization
and sending letters home about their exploits. These letters were collected, published in yearly volumes. They're called the Jesuit Relations.
And many a young anthropology major has used the Jesuit Relations for his research on the Aboriginal American Indian and their culture. The Jesuit Relations, even now, are regarded as a very accurate source of information about Aboriginal culture. So completely did these missionary Jesuits identify with the Indians, that they lived with them, learned the subtleties of their daily habits. When these Jesuit relations were bound in volumes and published, these Jesuit relations were widely read all over Europe as a source of great fascination and educational interest.
This served to make the New France colony better known. In addition, Champlain's letters and visits to France encouraged colonists to come to Quebec and persuade businessmen to invest in the fur trade.
You know, I was an undergraduate anthropology major at one time, and I was preparing for a seminar. My professor directed me to the Jesuit relations. There were 72 volumes. It was quite a discovery, a treasury of information and great detail about the habits of the American Indians. I felt like I got to know some of these Indians personally. And even now I remember a comment by Father Murray in the Relations, who wrote, "When I came among these people, I thought I was bringing God to them. But when I came, I found out that he was already here." What great evangelists the people of this period were, these French missionaries. They provide a model so far beyond what we can hope to attain, but we have to try anyway. What we have to pray for is more boldness, more bold holiness. Stay with us after the break. I've got some real interesting stories to tell you about the bold evangelization of the French missionaries.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. Yes, it's France and the New World on Setting the Record Straight. During the colonization of North America, the Catholic French colonies provide an example of what a colonization by Christians should look like. We were talking about the great explorer Champlain. He must have been a very persuasive gentleman. We read the story of how he encouraged people to come to New France to colonize it. And most importantly, he was able to persuade the Prime Minister, Richelieu, the rather wayward cardinal, to support New France. In 1627, Richelieu organized a company of 100 associates, which financed the journeys of 300 colonists each year and supported them in New France for another 3 years. So finally, Quebec had families instead of just single men and artisans and skilled workers instead of just adventurers. Just a few months after the British had established Jamestown down in Virginia, the colony which failed, Champlain had established his first colony on the site of Quebec. Now, Jamestown didn't fare so well. They had a lot of conflict with the local Native American tribes in the first years, and it brought Jamestown to the brink of failure. They also had a lot of famine and disease. But while the British colonists were having that rough beginning down in Virginia, back up in New France, things were going rather well until 1629, when the British cast envious eyes on what was going on there and decided to take it over. And they attacked the French Canadian colony and destroyed it. The greatly outnumbered French in Quebec were forced to surrender to the British fleet. Now, France got their colony back as a reward for France's payment of the dowry of the French princess Henrietta Maria, who had married King Charles I of England. But that was about 4 or 5 years later. So Champlain, he's getting older now, began all over again. And in the short time left in his life, he set the colony firmly on the road to greatness. When he died on Christmas Day in 1635, he could look back on a record of accomplishment, exploration, the establishment of fur trading, a permanent colony, the beginning of missionary work, the creation of a spirit of unity and cooperation among all the French colonists, and almost all the Aboriginal Indian tribes.
The one exception was the savage Iroquois, who weren't at peace with the rest of the Indians anyway.
The Iroquois operated as what we would term a militaristic empire.
Other than that, Champlain gets the credit for the maintenance of peace with all of the Indians except for these savage Iroquois. Champlain's courage, faith, and determination left a wonderful legacy which endures to this day among the people we call the French Canadians in the province of Quebec. Now, when the first Jesuits arrived in France, about 10 years before Samuel Champlain died, they were led by a tall, broad-shouldered man whose physique was so mighty that the Indians gave him the title Echon, the Bear. His French name was Jean Brébeuf, and his only desire was to bring Christ to the Indians. In 1625, he went with a group of Montagnais to their village. Brébeuf knew that to convert the Indians, he would need to understand their language, their customs, their beliefs. To achieve this understanding, he would live with them. He spent the winter with the Montagnais, eating smoked eel, wiping his hands on the nearest dog after eating, sleeping on pine needles, never complaining about the filth, dirt, grease, mice, rats, lice, and fleas. To keep this short, I'm going to leave some other things out. In the summer of 1627, he built a small cabin where he could say mass and be free of the filth and smoke of the Indian huts. Every year he returned to the Indians, especially the Hurons, but made few converts. Most of the Indians preferred their world of dreams and witch doctors and demons. About 10 years later, an epidemic struck the Hurons. The witch doctors blamed Brébeuf, saying that his crucifix and his prayers had brought the plague on the Indians. For months, he and the other Jesuits lived in constant fear of death. In October, the Jesuits were so sure they were going to die that they imitated an Indian custom and invited all the Indians to a farewell feast. The Indians understood the food, but could not understand why the priest spoke only of the joy of going to God rather than the fear of demons. But the time of their martyrdom had not yet come. And in the meantime, still more Jesuits braved the perils of New France to bring Catholicism to the Indians, to bring Christ to the Indians, who did not seem to want him. In 1636, Isaac Jogues went to live with the Indians, who named him Ondesank, Bird of Prey. On All Saints' Day in 1639, Jogues and Father Garnier shouldered packets, picked up their staves, and began moving west. In their first night out, they huddled together in a small sheltered area. A fierce blizzard blew around them. Soon they ran into even worse problems. The Indians blamed them for the smallpox epidemic and refused to allow them to stay in any of their villages. They might have starved to death if an old chieftain whom they'd baptized had not taken them into his tent. At last, the Jesuits began making progress with the Hurons, but the vicious Iroquois remained hostile to Catholics. In the fall of 1642, Father Jogues, some other French men, and a few Indians were suddenly attacked by a band of Iroquois. Isaac hid in the tall grass while the battle raged, but when he saw that his friends had lost the battle and many of them were already dying, he boldly stood up and asked the Iroquois to put him in with the other prisoners. To the dying Indians he spoke consoling words, and wringing water out of his wet garments, baptized them. The next few weeks were a nightmare for the Catholics, both the French and the Indians. The Iroquois would grasp the natives' fingernails with their teeth and pull them out. They would chew their fingers until they were a jelly of blood and flesh. At every village they were forced to run the gauntlet, dashing as well as they could between the two lines of Indians armed with clubs and knives. They were given little food. They suffered from stifling heat and from insects swarming about their wounds. Isaac expected to be killed at any moment. But at last the Indians ceased their tortures, and he was allowed to live out the winter in an Iroquois hut. In the spring of 1643, the Iroquois were constantly on the warpath, using weapons and ammunition supplied by the Dutch Protestants, who were enemies of the French Catholics. Near Montreal, the settlers lived in such terror of the Indians that they scarcely dared leave their cabins. In August, a band of Iroquois came to a Dutch trading post to transact business. When the Dutch saw Father Jogues, they took pity on him and offered to help him escape. At first, he was not sure whether he should take the opportunity, since it would mean that he would be free of the sufferings which he wanted to offer up for the Indians. But after long hours of prayers, Isaac at last decided that it was God's will that he try to escape. The escape was almost as harrowing as his imprisonment. He was savagely bitten by a dog belonging to one of the Dutchmen, He had to spend several days cooped up in a small attic room belonging to a Dutchman who hated Catholics and who therefore gave Father Jogues practically nothing to eat or drink. He was put on board a Dutch ship bound for England, but could not land in England because the Puritans had decreed the death penalty for any priest who stepped onto English soil. But the Dutch ship captain slipped over to France and allowed Father Jogues to wade ashore onto Catholic French soil at last. It was Christmas Day, 1643, and Isaac was able to confess and receive Holy Communion for the first time in over a year. He journeyed on to the Jesuit house in Rome. When he arrived there, he found that his fellow Jesuits had all believed him dead and had been venerating him as a martyr. Since he no longer had thumbs because of the tortures, the Pope gave him a special dispensation to continue to say Mass. The Iroquois, knowing that the priests valued their forefingers and thumbs so they could say Mass and do the transubstantiation by holding the host aloft in the air, decided that they would cut off his thumbs. So the other Jesuits assumed that Isaac Jogues would settle down to a peaceful life in Europe on some easier duties. But Isaac could not remain away from his Indians. 1 year later, he was back in New France. He was first assigned to quiet duties in Montreal. But 2 years later, he returned to Iroquois territory on a mission to persuade the savages to lay down their arms and live peacefully with their neighbors. When the Iroquois saw him coming walking back into his village, after all they'd done in torturing him and treating him badly, they could not believe his bravery and his indomitable will. And that is what they called him ever after that. Indomitable. But that year he was captured by the Mohawks, which were a branch of the Iroquois, on October 18th of that year, 1646, in what is now New York State. Isaac and his companions were tomahawked to death. As Father Jogues suffered his martyrdom, Father Brebeuf was still working among the Hurons. A few settlements for Catholic Indians had been built, and the Jesuits were seeing the fruits of their long labors. But the Iroquois still hated the Black Robes, as the Indians called the Jesuits, Black Robes. Soon Father Brebeuf and Father Gabriel Lalemant were captured while trying to help the Hurons during an Iroquois attack. Like Father Jogues, they had to run the gauntlet. They were tied to torture posts where they were burned and slashed. Boiling water was poured on them. Their eyes were gouged out. All the while, Jean exhorted his companions to keep faith and think of the joys of heaven to come. At last, the Iroquois reached the end of their cruel sport. They scalped Father Brebeuf and tore out his heart, amazed at the courage of this pale-skinned man. They had been torturing him for a month. Altogether, 8 men of New France suffered martyrdom at the hands of the Indians. Father Jogues, his 2 layman companions, René Goupil and Jean de Lalande, Father Brebeuf and Father Lalemant, Father Anthony Daniel, who was killed in an attack while he was saying Mass, Father Charles Granier, who was tomahawked not long after the death of Father Brebeuf, and Father Noel Chabanel, who was killed by an apostate Huron, who confessed that he committed the murder out of hatred for Catholicism. After the deaths of the missionary, the Huron tribe slowly died out, but especially because of the depredations of the Iroquois. The Iroquois eventually accepted the Catholic faith, largely perhaps because of their admiration of the great courage of the Jesuit martyrs. The brave who murdered Father Isaac Jogues was later baptized, taking the baptismal name of Isaac Jogues.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. We've been reflecting on New France, France and the New World. Here on Setting the Record Straight, I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. I was telling you some inspiring stories about the bravery and dedication and devotion of the great Jesuit missionaries
who gave their all for evangelizing the Indians in what is now southern Canada and the northern United States. One wonderful result of this evangelization was the first female saint of North America.
An Iroquois maiden, Kateri Tekawita, lived a life of chastity and concentration to God in the midst of temptation and persecution.
Was the first Native American to be beatified. The Aboriginal Native Indians of that area were greatly inspired by the message of Christ that these missionaries brought with them from the distant land of Europe.
The Jesuits' courage was also an example and an inspiration to the settlers of New France, who remained steadfast in the Catholic faith.
At present, our church is involved in a new evangelization, which involves all the lay people, not just the clergy. And we need to be inspired by what the old evangelization was like. We hardly come up to their ankles.
Now let's talk about the nuns, the heroines of New France. In 1639, one of the many ships which sailed back and forth from France to New France left the old world with three very special passengers aboard. Marie Guillard, a widow who had raised a son, and was now Mother Marie of the Incarnation, and Ursuline Nun and her two companions. The three women were on their way to Quebec to set up a school for both the French and the Indian children. When they arrived, Quebec was still very much a struggling colony. The women were lodged in a shack in the shelter of the Great Clift. Almost immediately, they found themselves nursing the victims of a smallpox epidemic. They had few supplies and very little space within their small house to care for the victims. But so well did they nurse the sick children that only four died. Over the next 30 years, the nuns would play a great part in the growth and development of Quebec.
They always had to endure many hardships, but especially at first.
Their diet consisted of salt fish, salt pork, and sagamite. And now sagamite is sort of a corn broth, a ground corn boiled into a porridge. They were constantly cold. Mother Marie gave her nuns permission to say their prayers in bed because the chapel was so cold they couldn't concentrate, and they never seemed to be rid of the dirt. Once they even found a moccasin boiling in their soup pot. But their school was a success. The nuns educated and civilized the Indian girls so they would be good wives to the French settlers or to be messengers of the Catholic faith and of civilization back in their home tribes. The nuns provided an excellent example of Catholic womanhood, since the Indian girls were used to seeing women treated as little better than slaves. Even the Iroquois sent their daughters to the Ursuline school. But the nuns suffered a great setback when their convent burned to the ground. The sisters and the little girls escaped into the night with scarcely time to dress, but Mother Marie refused to despair. She started all over again, writing to France to raise money, then budgeting it carefully so that every penny was put to good use. And 4 years later, a beautiful new convent school was completed. Marie proved herself both a talented executive and a mystic of deep faith and charity. Her school is the oldest convent school in North America, and it still exists.
But Mother Marie was not the only one. What Mother Marie did for Quebec, another woman did for Montreal.
14 years after Marie sailed from France, an old sailing ship left France with about 120 settlers, bound for Ville Marie, as Montreal was then known. The leader was Paul de Maisonneuve, founder and governor of the new colony, who had left only 17 colonists when he returned to France the previous year. Now he was bringing people with all the skills necessary to start the colony on the road to prosperity. On board was Marguerite Bergigoy, who was to be the teacher of the settlement's children. At first, Marguerite taught primarily catechism and housekeeping skills with the girls, who were called the King's Girls. These girls, usually orphans, or from large families whose parents could not afford the dowries they needed to be married, were brought to New France at the expense of the French government to provide wives for the French settlers. When the girls arrived, they and the unmarried Frenchmen would look each other over. The girls would ask a lot of questions. For example, how many rooms in your house? And do you drink? And choices would be made. Priests were on hand to marry the couples, and then they would be off to the bridegroom's house, receiving from the government wedding gifts of an ox, cow, 2 pigs, 2 chickens, 2 barrels of salted meat, and 11 crowns. Since the king wanted New France to be more thickly populated, the government also gave bonuses for large families. Soon there were many children in the colonies, and Marguerite opened her school. The first was for 7 children in a small building, which had been a stable, but it grew rapidly. Marguerite recruited additional teachers, and the women formed themselves into a religious community. Eventually it was called the Congregation de Notre Dame, the Congregation of Our Lady. They opened a boarding school, a vocational school, and began teaching Indian as well as French children. The congregation grew, and Marie's nuns went throughout the territory, establishing convents and schools. A bishop was appointed for New France. His name was Blessed Francis Xavier de Laval. He arrived in Quebec in 1659. The saintly bishop lived simply. He rose early, opening the church, ringing the bell himself, and saying the first Mass of the day at 4:30 a.m., even in winter when all was cold and dark. He slept on a straw mattress, ate 2 frugal meals a day, and gave away most of his income to the poor. During the day, he was always busy performing the corporal and spiritual works of mercy. During a fever epidemic, he worked in the hospital, doing even the most menial chores, such as making beds. When the day finally ended, he prayed the rosary before retiring for his few hours of sleep. Blessed Francis Xavier de Laval believed strongly that Quebec should be a Catholic country and a Catholic society, rather than merely a society which had Catholics in it, and he encouraged the laws of the colony to reflect the laws of God. He set up a seminary, a high school, a technical school, and an agricultural school. He was very popular with Indians, and even baptized the Iroquois chief, Gatatantic, in the cathedral at Quebec. He served the people of Quebec for nearly 50 years. Even when he was old and sick, he still got up at 2 a.m., dressed in the cold. He had to carry on his duties because his appointed successor had been captured by the British at sea and was being held prisoner. One Good Friday, he had to be carried to the cathedral to officiate its services. It was 1708. The cathedral was so cold that frostbite set in. He was so old and had such poor circulation in his legs, so he was soon afflicted by gangrene. As he lay dying, one of those near asked him to give them his last words, as the saints had often done. He only shook his head and replied, "They were saints. I'm a sinner." At his death, all New France mourned the loss of their shepherd.
But I want you to understand that there still was exploring going on. To the west of them in North America was a vast, unknown wilderness.
When New France gradually became civilized, brave explorers pushed into unknown territories. The wise and far-seeing governor general of New France,
Comte Louis de Frontenac,
encouraged these explorations. He appointed Louis Joliet to explore the then unknown waters beyond Lake Michigan. With him went Father Jacques Marquette, a Jesuit priest who undertook the journey to evangelize the Indians. I think we may all know the names Joliet and Marquette. Well, this was 1673. So with 5 other men and 2 bark canoes, Joliet and Marquette left the mission of St. Ignatius at the point where Lake Huron and Michigan meet. They placed their journey under the patronage of the Immaculate Conception. In about a month, they reached the limit of the previously explored area. They stopped to rest with some friendly Indian tribes, and they were warned of demons and serpents who would swallow them if they proceeded down the Great River, which was their goal. But they intended to go on. They probably didn't believe in the serpents.
But Marquette and Joliet knew that many other dangers did await them.
They moved on anyway. A few days later, they left the friendly Indians and portaged their canoes from the Fox to the Wisconsin rivers. A week later, they canoed at last into the great Mississippi. "With a joy I cannot express," wrote Father Marquette in his journal,
"the broad magnificence of the river
thrilled them. The priest remarked on the slow, gentle current which carried their canoes along, and on the monstrous fish. The small expedition proceeded cautiously, not sure if the Indians along the bank would be friendly or not. When at last they did put in at a village, the Indians were friendly and welcomed them. I have an amateur's theory about why this friendliness existed, and did for Lewis and Clark later. For thousands of years, the Mississippi River and its tributaries had been highways on which traders went up and down, stopping at villages. The traders included peoples from distant places, as far distant as Cuba and the Caribbean islands. Some of the beautiful seashells from the Caribbean have been found far up into Canada. Perhaps the people living in the riverbank villages always welcomed people, hoping to trade with them. I do wish I could have seen that country and that river the way it looked to them, in its unspoiled splendor. During this break, I'm going to imagine how it all looked back then.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. Glad you stuck around. We're back after a break. As events turned out, the French colonization of the Americas was not as successful or as widespread as that of the Spanish. Well, this program is about the French and the Americas. But stepping off the trail for a minute, what about the Spanish? The greatest benefit they brought was Catholicism itself. The dark gods were dethroned. The Indians were converted. To this day, Latin America remains Catholic. They did a great job, but it wasn't a perfect job. The greatest weakness of the Spanish missionary effort was the failure to train a native clergy so that the government of the church in the New World remained in the hands of those of European descent. But another strength of Spanish rule was the treatment of natives as fellow citizens and the gradual creation of a multiracial society in which intermarriage was common. Spanish rule created a flourishing culture, which was truly a new culture, a new world culture, a blend of Spanish and native, mestizo. The University of Mexico was founded in 1553, 80 years before Harvard University in Massachusetts. By 1800, New Spain had 40 colleges and universities. The New World had poets, painters, sculptors, musicians. The final point to be made in evaluating the Spanish rule in the New World is to distinguish between the two dynasties that ruled there, the Habsburgs and the Bourbons. The Habsburgs, who ruled from 1515 until 1700, believed in local self-government and local rights. The Bourbons were absolutists and greatly weakened the Habsburg governmental system, both in Spain itself and in the New World. It's quite possible that if the Habsburg system had remained in effect, the bloody Latin American revolutions of the 1800s would have never taken place. That was just a word about the Spanish. But let's step back over into the French in the New World. But let's go back a couple hundred years. Joliet, Marquette are sitting by the riverside. They're on the Mississippi banks. And they found they were very welcome with these friendly people. They sat and smoked the peace pipe with them. After which Father Marquette told the Indians of God's love and mercy, and they all enjoyed a great feast of sagamite, fish, dog, and wild ox. They continued down the ever-widening river, passing the Missouri River. They saw rich veins of iron and were plagued by mosquitoes. When they came to the point where the Arkansas River empties into the Mississippi. They debated whether to continue. It was clear that the Mississippi flowed south, and Joliet's main commission was to find a westward passage, not a southern passage. And they were very concerned that they'd soon be coming into the territory of the Spaniards. And if they were inclined to do so, the Spaniards could give them a lot more trouble than demons and serpents. So they turned back toward Canada. After that voyage, Marquette lived for a while in a log cabin. He'd picked a significant site. It was the place where one day a city would rise, a city called Chicago. And there he continued his evangelization of the Indians. But the mighty Mississippi beckoned another French explorer. When Joliet returned to Quebec, he found an eager listener to his tales of the great river,
Robert Cartier de La Salle. We usually talk about him as Robert de La Salle. De La Salle was a 30-year-old Frenchman
who had already made a reputation as a brave explorer in the wilderness, but also as a hot-tempered young man in civilized surroundings. He made so many enemies that once a salad was poisoned, and he was ill for 5 weeks. La Salle could have had a well-paying job as a commander at Fort Frontenac, but money was not what he was interested in. His dream was to explore the Mississippi all the way to the end. He began his journey at Niagara Falls, where he built a small ship, it's called the Griffin, to carry his expedition through the Great Lakes. With a crew of 34 men, La Salle set out. He also had a Jesuit priest,
Louise Hennepin,
and two other priests. They became the first white men to sail out of Lake Erie, and by August they reached Lake Huron. This is in 1679. At the entrance to Lake Michigan, La Salle sent the Griffin back to Quebec with furs, which they had gathered to satisfy his many creditors. With the rest of his men, La Salle continued in canoes. The water was so rough that they almost capsized, but La Salle pushed forward.
Well, that's when the problems began. They ran low on food.
The Griffin did not reappear with supplies as they had promised. The men grumbled. One man aimed a gun at La Salle's back as they marched along. La Salle always insisted on marching at the head of his men, but another man knocked it out of his hand before he could shoot him. By the end of December, they'd reached the Illinois River, where they spent a bitter winter. In January, 6 men deserted, leaving poison in La Salle's porridge.
For the second time, he almost died of poisoning. But La Salle refused to give up his dream.
He led his men in building a fort and another ship, though his two carpenters had run away. He dispatched Father Hennepin and some of the men to explore the upper Mississippi. When the spring thaws came in 1680, La Salle and a few men left marched back through the mud up to their knees to French settlements to get supplies. He found that the Griffin had sunk with all his furs aboard, that people were calling him wasteful, crazy, and dishonest. When he reached Montreal, he found that the only person still on his side was Frontenac.
Frontenac helped him get further money and supplies. When he got back to the wilderness, he found that more of his men had deserted, stealing the few remaining supplies.
When he reached the fort, he found no sign of Tonty, the man he had left in charge. His expedition seemed to be lost, but La Salle again refused to give up. Eventually, Tonty returned. He'd been helping defend friendly Illinois Indians against the Iroquois, who were on the war path yet again, as if they were ever not on the war path. Finally, this is 2 years later, after he'd gotten back to the wilderness, they set out in their canoes on the Mississippi. This turned out to be the easiest part of the exploration. The canoes floated smoothly down the wide river. They passed canebrakes and cypress forests and alligators. They passed the Arkansas, the outer limits of Marquette's and Joliet's exploration. It took them 3 months, but they reached the mouth of the Mississippi. La Salle ordered the erection of a column and a cross. They sang the Te Deum and fired their guns. La Salle had reached the mouth of his river. On the way back, it wasn't as easy. They had to stroke hard upstream, fighting the current. They lived on wild potatoes, alligator meat, they finally got up to the Illinois River and decided to stay. They were exhausted. They sent a message to Quebec that the exploration had succeeded. But nobody believed him. Father Hennepin had been spreading stories, giving himself credit for LaSalle's exploration. And Frontenac, his best friend, had been recalled to France.
It took a year, but LaSalle got back to Paris and enlisted colonists to create a colony at the mouth of the Mississippi River.
He returned to the New World with 4 ships, 400 people, but his attempt on colonizing met one difficulty after another.
They sailed through a hurricane. When they reached the Gulf of Mexico, LaSalle couldn't find the mouth of his river.
Because of inaccurate maps.
And also because of the confusing appearance of the coastline in that area.
And they settled on the coast of Texas. They spent months searching for the river while the colonists died from sickness and lack of food. After 2 years, while LaSalle was leading his few remaining able-bodied colonists in search of the river, he was ambushed and shot. The colony was later wiped out by an Indian attack. 14 years later, a French exploratory voyage found the mouth of the Mississippi. There they met an Indian who had a letter from Tonty to LaSalle. Tonty had sailed down the Mississippi from the north looking for LaSalle. When he did not find the explorer, he left the letter with the Indians who had kept it all those years. But you can say this, that LaSalle had opened up the Mississippi Valley. It was now the possession of the French king and was named Louisiana after King Louis XIV. A French colony was established at Biloxi. And 10 years later at Mobile. 8 years after that at New Orleans.
Our own New Orleans, with its delicious French atmosphere and character and heritage.
Quebec, Montreal, Detroit, Chicago, the Mississippi Valley, New Orleans.
The French influence spread through a lot of the New World.
The French presence meant fur trading, attempts to convert and civilize the Indians, and very friendly relationships with them, for the most part.
And a gentler, more gradual settlement and colonization.
The history books pay a lot more attention to the Spanish. The Spanish achievements were indeed far more spectacular than those of the French.
But these French Catholics contributed their share
of great achievements, martyrs, heroes, to the beginning of the New World.
In 1763, Britain won Canada. Britain's first intention was to repress the Catholic faith in the favor of an official Anglican settlement. But this plan fell apart. Catholics were granted freedom of religion. Catholic loyalty to British Canada in the War of 1812 won the church further freedom to establish territorial bishoprics and to control Catholic schools for the first time.
This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. We're on BreadboxMedia.com. And we've offered today a few words of praise for the French Catholic colonists, brave and courageous,